A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants us to take apart the brand new UE-Iran-Islamabad Memorandum of Understanding, signed Wednesday, June 18th. President Trump, Iranian President Pezeshkian, and Pakistan's Prime Minister as mediator. He wants a skeptical read, clause by clause. What's binding? What's kicked to a final deal? Within 60 days? Where the $300 billion reconstruction pledge actually comes from, what's real in the nuclear paragraph versus what's a loophole, and the asymmetry of obligations across the whole thing. So let's do exactly that.
I've spent the last 2 days reading this line by line, and what struck me first, this is not a peace treaty. It's not even a ceasefire agreement, really. It's a memorandum of understanding. That's a specific legal creature. It says, quote, "We intend to do things later." The entire structure is built around a 60-day clock that either produces a final deal or...
If it doesn't, we're back to where we were, minus whatever one side already gave away in the interim. So let's start at the top. Clause 1. Immediate and permanent termination of military operations on all fronts, including Lebanon. Both sides undertake not to initiate war or military operations against each other, and to refrain from threats or use of force.
It sounds comprehensive, but look at what it actually binds. The clause says the ceasefire is immediate and permanent, and then immediately says, quote, "The final deal will confirm the permanent termination of the war." So which is it? Is the war permanently over now, or does permanence require the final deal? Because if talks collapse on day 59, does the permanent cessation evaporate? The text wants it both ways.
It's a ceasefire wearing a tuxedo. And the Lebanon peace, ensuring the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Lebanon. That's a declaratory sentence with no mechanism. Who ensures it? What happens if Hezbollah rearms? None of that is addressed.
Clause 2 is the boilerplate sovereignty respect language. Undertake to respect each other's sovereignty and territorial integrity and to refrain from interfering in each other's internal affairs. On its face, fine. But Iran's entire regional strategy for 40 years has been interference in the internal affairs of other states through proxy forces. There's no definition of what interference means, no mechanism to adjudicate it, and no consequence if it continues. This is aspiration dressed as obligation.
The word undertake is doing a lot of work throughout this document. It's not shall, it's not must. It's undertake to, which in diplomatic language means, we promise to try. Herman, you spent a career reading medical literature where precision matters. How does undertake read to you?
It reads like a parent saying, I'll think about it. Now, clause 3 is where the clock starts. Both sides commit to negotiating the final deal within a maximum of 60 days, extendable by mutual consent. So the extension requires both parties to agree. If one side wants to walk, the clock runs out. What happens then? The document doesn't say. The entire MOU just.
What's happened on the ground by day 60? Let's go to clause 4, because this is where the asymmetry gets tangible. Immediately upon signing, the United States begins removing its naval blockade, full removal within 30 days. During that period, vessel traffic scales in proportion to pre-war levels as Iran restores it, also undertakes to remove forces from proximity to Iran within 30 days, but only after the final deal.
That's the key distinction. The blockade removal is front-loaded and unconditional. The force removal from the region, that's contingent on the final deal, but the blockade is the main point of leverage. Once that's lifted, what incentive does Iran have to make hard concessions in the negotiations?
The sequence is, America gives up its primary pressure tool in the first 30 days, and then hopes the negotiations produce Iranian concessions in the next 30. That's not how leverage works.
Clause 5 is Iran's reciprocal obligation on the Strait of Hormuz. Iran will use, quote, best efforts for the safe passage of commercial vessels, with no charge for 60 days only. Best efforts, that's not a guarantee. That's a shrug with nicer phrasing. The traffic restoration happens within 30 days, but Iran gets to cite technical and military obstacles and demining as reasons for delay, and the long-term administration of the strait gets kicked to discussions with Oman and other Gulf states later. So Iran's obligation is time-limited, 60 days of free passage, and qualified by best efforts.
Meanwhile, Clause 6, this is the one that made my eyes widen. The United States undertakes, with regional partners, to develop a, quote, definitive mutually agreed plan with at least $300 billion for the reconstruction and economic development of Iran. $300 billion. Where does that come from?
The text says, with regional partners, which I read is code for Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, the Gulf states. The United States is essentially volunteering its allies' money. And it's not just a pledge. The mechanism for implementation will be finalized as part of the final deal within 60 days, and all required financial licenses, waivers, and permissions will be granted by the EU. So America is underwriting the financial plumbing for a $300 billion transfer to Iran, while the actual funding is supposed to come from partners who may or may not have agreed to this.
What do those partners get? They're not mentioned anywhere else in the document. They didn't sign it. They're not at the table. But their checkbooks are apparently open. There's a Reuters report I saw that noted the Gulf states were not consulted on this specific figure before the signing. If that's accurate, this is the EU making a commitment on behalf of third parties who may have very different views about funding Iran's reconstruction while its proxy network across the region remains intact.
Clause 7. Total sanctions termination. UN Security Council resolutions, IAEA Board of Governors resolutions, all unilateral EU sanctions, primary and secondary, all of it, terminated on an, quote, agreed-upon schedule as part of the final deal. This is enormous. The sanctions architecture against Iran has been built over decades, across multiple administrations, through executive orders, congressional statutes, and international bodies. This clause promises to dismantle all of it. But the schedule is to be negotiated, so Iran gets a commitment to total sanctions relief, while the UA commitment to negotiate the schedule. The obligation is asymmetric again.
Once sanctions are lifted, they're not easy to snap back. Congress has to be involved for some of these. The UN Security Council has to pass a new resolution. The machinery of sanctions relief is slow to build and almost impossible to reassemble quickly. So if Iran violates the final deal 6 months after sanctions are gone, what's the enforcement mechanism? The document doesn't provide one. Which brings us to Clause 8, the nuclear paragraph, where the rubber is politely asked to consider meeting the road at a later date.
Let me read the key language. Iran, quote, reaffirms that it shall not procure or develop nuclear weapons. Then, the two parties agree to resolve the disposition of stockpiled enriched material pursuant to a mechanism that will be mutually agreed upon, with the minimum methodology to be downblending on-site under IAEA supervision. And then, the two parties agree to discuss the issue of enrichment and other mutually agreed matters relating to Iran's nuclear needs, based on a satisfactory framework being agreed upon in the final deal.
Let's unpack that. Shall not procure or develop nuclear weapons. That's a reaffirmation of something Iran has said for years. It's not a new concession. The disposition of enriched material is to be resolved by a mechanism not yet designed, on a schedule not yet set. The minimum is downblending on site, which means Iran keeps the material, keeps it in country, and dilutes it under IAEA watch. But minimum methodology implies there could be other options, and we don't know what they are. And enrichment itself, the core activity that produces the material you need for a weapon, is merely to be discussed, based on a satisfactory framework to be agreed upon. Who decides what's satisfactory? So Iran has a veto over any framework it doesn't like.
The entire nuclear architecture of this MOU is, Iran keeps its program, keeps its material, keeps its enrichment capability, and agrees to talk about what limits might apply later. In exchange, the United States lifts the blockade, terminates sanctions, and organizes $300 billion in reconstruction. If you're scoring this as a negotiation, the nuclear side is all deferred commitments, and the economic side is all front-loaded concessions. The word that jumped out at me was satisfactory. That's not verifiable. That's not enforceable. It's a subjective standard that either party can reject. If Iran decides no framework is satisfactory, what happens? The paragraph doesn't say.
Clause 9 is the status quo freeze pending the final deal. Iran maintains the current status quo of its nuclear program, will not impose any new sanctions, and will not deploy additional forces in the region. So during the negotiation period, Iran's program stays exactly where it is, which, by most estimates, means it continues operating, enriching, stockpiling, ties its own hands on sanctions and force posture. That's not a freeze, that's a one-sided constraint. And current status quo is doing a lot of work. What level of enrichment? What size stockpile? What centrifuge deployment? None of that is defined. So, maintain the status quo means whatever Iran says it means.
Clause 10. Oil export waivers. Immediately upon signing, and until sanctions are terminated, the EU Treasury will issue waivers for Iranian crude oil, petroleum products, derivatives, and all associated services, including banking, insurance, and transportation. This is effectively a license for Iran to resume full oil exports before any nuclear commitments are finalized. The revenue spigot opens on day one.
Clause 11. The frozen assets undertakes to make fully available for use all frozen or restricted funds and assets of Iran upon implementation of the MOU, not upon the final deal, upon implementation of this MOU. The two parties will mutually agree on release procedures during negotiations, but the funds shall be made fully usable for payment to any beneficiary designated by Iran's central bank.
Estimates vary, but Iranian frozen assets globally are in the range of $100 billion, with significant portions held in South Korea, Japan, and various European jurisdictions. Is committing to issue all necessary licenses to free that money, and Iran gets to designate the ultimate beneficiary. The text explicitly says the funds can be paid to any ultimate beneficiary, which means they could flow to entities currently sanctioned for terrorism financing or proliferation activities as long as Iran's central bank signs off.
That's not a loophole. That's a door propped open with a brick. Clause 12. An executive mechanism to monitor implementation and compliance. What's the mechanism?
It doesn't say. It says an executive mechanism will be established. No details on composition, authority, access, reporting, or enforcement. Compare this to the JCPOA's Joint Commission, which had a defined structure, working groups, and a dispute resolution mechanism that could lead to snapback. This MOU says, we'll figure out monitoring later.
Clause 13 is the sequencing paragraph. After signing, and subject to the beginning of implementation of the ceasefire, blockade removal, strait passage, oil waivers, and asset release, all the front-loaded concessions, negotiations on the final deal begin, quote, exclusively on the other paragraphs. So, all the hard stuff, nuclear details, sanction schedule, reconstruction mechanism, verification, gets negotiated only after the economic and military concessions are already in motion.
The sequence is, America and its allies give first, Iran negotiates later. That's not a framework for a deal. That's a framework for being taken to the cleaners.
Clause 14. The final deal will be endorsed by a binding UN Security Council resolution. This is supposed to be the backstop. But a binding UNSC resolution requires Russia and China not to veto. Given the current geopolitical alignment, Russia and China have every incentive to support a resolution that lifts sanctions on Iran and constrains EU. So the backstop is real, but it's a backstop that also locks in the concessions.
Here's what I keep coming back to. The entire document is structured around a 60-day negotiation window that culminates in a final deal. But what if there's no final deal? The MOU is silent on reversion. It doesn't say sanctions snap back. It doesn't say the blockade resumes. It doesn't say frozen assets are refrozen. The assumption baked into the text is that the final deal will happen. There's no plan B articulated anywhere.
Because acknowledging plan B would mean admitting that the front-loaded concessions might be permanent and the deferred commitments might be imaginary. Let's talk about Pakistan's role as mediator. Pakistan hosted the signing. The Prime Minister is a signatory. What does Pakistan get out of this?
Pakistan gets regional relevance, a seat at the table, and leverage with both Washington and Tehran. It also positions itself as the indispensable diplomatic intermediary for any future crises. But Pakistan's own relationship with Iran is complicated. They share a border. There are Balochistan militancy issues. There's smuggling. There's Saudi-Pakistan dynamics. Pakistan has its own interests here that don't necessarily align with either parties. And it's not exactly a neutral broker. It has its own nuclear program, its own history of proliferation, its own tensions with India. Putting Pakistan in the mediator's chair adds a layer of complexity the document doesn't address.
Let's zoom out and ask the question the MOU doesn't answer. What problem is this actually solving? The war stops. That's genuinely significant. Lives are saved. The blockade ends. But the underlying drivers of the conflict, Iran's nuclear program, its proxy network, its ballistic missile arsenal, its regional ambitions, none of those are resolved by this document. They're deferred to a negotiation that may or may not produce a final deal, with no consequences specified if it doesn't.
The asymmetry isn't subtle. Let's list it. Gives, blockade removal in 30 days, oil waivers immediately, frozen asset release immediately, no new sanctions, no additional forces, a $300 billion reconstruction commitment, total sanctions termination in the final deal. Iran gives a ceasefire best effort straight passage for 60 days, a reaffirmation that it won't build nukes, and a promise to discuss enrichment later. The best efforts straight passage is the one that really gets me. The Strait of Hormuz is the choke point for something like 20% of global oil transit, and Iran's commitment to keep it open is qualified by best efforts and time limited to 60 days. After that, long-term administration gets negotiated with Oman and Gulf states. The world's most critical maritime choke point is secured by a we'll try for 2 months.
The IAEA's role is mentioned exactly once, in the nuclear paragraph where downblending happens under IAEA supervision. But IAEA access to other sites, the additional protocol, the broader inspections regime, none of that is in the document. The IAEA spent years trying to get answers about undeclared sites, about traces of enriched uranium found at locations Iran never declared. This MOU doesn't address any of that.
Because it can't. The MOU is not a nuclear agreement. It's a ceasefire with a nuclear question mark attached. The actual nuclear constraints, if any, will be in the final deal. But the final deal is negotiated after Iran already has its sanctions relief, its oil revenue, its unfrozen assets, and its blockade-free shipping lanes.
What do you make of the reconstruction figure specifically? $300 billion. That's roughly Iran's GDP.
It's also roughly the estimated cost of rebuilding after years of sanctions, conflict damage, and economic isolation. But who verifies how it's spent? The MOU says the mechanism will be in the final deal. So there's no current commitment to transparency, no anti-corruption provisions, no restrictions on use. $300 billion with no strings attached yet. And regional partners funding it means, in practice, the Gulf Arab states that have spent years opposing Iranian expansionism are now being asked to finance Iran's recovery. The political dynamics of that are complicated, to put it mildly.
There's a line in Clause 7 I want to highlight. It says both parties, quote, acknowledge the critical importance of the sanctions termination issue and express their intentions to immediately address these issues in the negotiations in order to achieve mutual agreement on them. That's not a commitment. That's an acknowledgement of importance, plus an expression of intention. The entire sanctions architecture is held together by, we agree this matters, and we intend to talk about it. It's the diplomatic equivalent of a save-the-date card for a wedding that hasn't been planned yet.
Let's talk about what's not in this document at all. No mention of Iran's ballistic missile program. No mention of proxy forces beyond the Lebanon reference in Clause 1. No mention of hostage releases. No mention of human rights. No mention of cyber operations. The scope is deliberately narrow. Ceasefire, blockade, sanctions, nukes, and even on nukes, it's mostly deferred. The ballistic missile omission is glaring. Iran's missile program is the delivery system for any nuclear weapon it might develop. The UN Security Council resolutions that this IOU promises to terminate include restrictions on Iran's missile activities. If those resolutions are terminated as part of sanctions relief, the missile constraints go with them.
The sequence could be sanctions terminated, missile restrictions lifted, enrichment continues at current levels, stockpile down blended on site but not removed, and the final deal. Negotiations produce, The leverage to get Iranian concessions has already been spent.
I want to be fair for a moment. The counter-argument, and I've seen it made, is that this MOU is just a confidence-building measure. It stops the shooting, creates space for diplomacy, and the final deal is where the real constraints will be negotiated. The front-loaded concessions are the price of getting Iran to the table at all. And if the final deal collapses, the argument goes that you can always reimpose sanctions and redeploy forces.
Can it, though? Once the blockade is lifted, reimposing it means a new military mobilization. Once sanctions are terminated, reimposing them means new legislation, new executive orders, new UN resolutions. Once frozen assets are released and spent, they're gone. The snapback theory assumes that what was dismantled can be quickly reassembled, and in practice, it almost never can. The JCPOA had a snapback mechanism explicitly designed for this. It was built into the UN Security Council resolution. This MOU doesn't have one. It says the final deal will be endorsed by a binding UNSC resolution, but it doesn't say that resolution will include snapback. It doesn't say what happens if Iran violates the final deal. It doesn't say what happens if there is no final deal.
That's the structural problem. The MOU creates a one-way ratchet. Concessions flow from the EU and its allies to Iran on a fixed schedule. Iranian concessions flow, eventually, maybe, if the final deal happens, and if it's satisfactory to both parties. The asymmetry is baked into the sequencing. And Clause 9, the status quo freeze, actually locks in that asymmetry. During negotiations, Iran's nuclear program continues unchanged, can't impose new sanctions or deploy additional forces. So Iran's leverage increases as negotiations proceed, because the EU has fewer options and Iran has given up nothing it wasn't already doing.
The phrase status quo appears in Clause 9 without definition. What is the status quo of Iran's nuclear program as of June 18, 2026? We don't know precisely, and the document doesn't specify. If Iran was already enriching to 60%, does status quo mean they continue enriching to 60%? The text doesn't clarify, and the IAEA, as of its most recent reports, has documented Iran's growing stockpile of highly enriched material, its installation of advanced centrifuges, and its reduced cooperation with inspectors. If that's the status quo being frozen, it's not a reassuring baseline.
Let's go back to Clause 4 for a moment. The blockade removal happens in stages, with vessel traffic scaling, quote, in proportion to the numbers of pre-war traffic being restored by Iran. So the pace of blockade relief is tied to Iran's restoration of traffic. But who verifies the pre-war numbers? Who measures the proportion? There's no mechanism specified. That's a recurring theme. The document is full of commitments that require measurement, verification, and adjudication, but the mechanisms for all three are deferred to the final deal or simply not mentioned. The executive mechanism in Clause 12 is supposed to handle monitoring, but it hasn't been established yet and has no defined powers.
We have a document that stops a war, which is valuable, but does so by front-loading economic and military concessions, deferring all meaningful Iranian commitments to a negotiation that may or may not succeed, with no snapback, no verification mechanism, and no plan B. The $300 billion reconstruction pledge is unfunded and unverified. The nuclear constraints are aspirational. The sanctions relief is total, but unscheduled. And the entire thing rests on a 60-day clock with no consequences if it expires.
I think the fairest read is this. The MOU is a bet. The bet is that the ceasefire holds, that the negotiations produce a final deal, and that the final deal includes verifiable nuclear constraints that justify the concessions made up front. It might work, but if it doesn't, the United States will have given up most of its leverage for a temporary ceasefire and a promise to talk.
The history of EU-Iran negotiations doesn't exactly inspire confidence in the trust us, the real deal is coming, approach. The JCPOA took years to negotiate and still left major gaps. This MOU gives itself 60 days to resolve everything the JCPOA couldn't, plus all the issues that have emerged since. The JCPOA had the benefit of multilateral negotiation, the P5+1, the EU, years of technical discussions. This was mediated by Pakistan and signed in what appears to be a compressed time frame. The final deal is supposed to cover nuclear details, sanctions scheduling, reconstruction mechanisms, verification, and enforcement, all within 60 days, extendable only by mutual consent.
If Iran decides it doesn't like where the negotiations are heading, it can simply refuse to extend. The clock runs out. Iran keeps its ceasefire, its oil revenue, its unfrozen assets, its blockade-free shipping, and its nuclear program exactly where it is left with a memory of leverage.
Clause 13 says, negotiations on the final deal begin exclusively on the other paragraphs after the front-loaded measures are implemented. That means the nuclear paragraph, the sanctions termination, the reconstruction plan, all of that is negotiated only after the ceasefire, blockade removal, street passage, oil waivers, and asset release are already underway. The hard stuff is deliberately backloaded. It's like signing a contract to buy a house where you hand over the money, the seller keeps living there, and you negotiate the move-out date later.
Let's talk about the Israeli dimension, because this MOU has enormous implications for Israel that the document doesn't address at all. Israel is not mentioned, not a signatory, not a party, not consulted. But the MOU directly affects Israel's security. The ceasefire includes Lebanon, which means Hezbollah. The nuclear paragraph leaves enrichment on the table. The sanctions relief frees up funds that could flow to proxies. And the removal of U forces from the region changes the military balance. Israel's entire security doctrine is built around preventing a nuclear Iran and maintaining qualitative military edge. This MOU touches both.
The 30-day blockade removal and forced drawdown timeline means Israel's window for any independent action narrows considerably. Forces are withdrawn and the blockade is gone. The military equation shifts. I'm not advocating anything. I'm just noting that the document creates facts on the ground that constrain options. I saw the Times of Israel report that senior Israeli officials described the MOU as a cash for ceasefire arrangement that leaves the nuclear threat fully intact. And they're not wrong on the text.
The nuclear threat is not just intact, it's potentially strengthened. If sanctions are lifted, oil revenue flows, and frozen assets are released, Iran's economy recovers. A recovered economy can fund a more ambitious nuclear program, more advanced centrifuges, more proxy activity. The MOU doesn't constrain Iran's capabilities. It constrains America's ability to pressure Iran while leaving Iran's capabilities untouched. And the downblending language in Clause 8, minimum methodology to be downblending on site, means the enriched material stays in Iran. It gets diluted, but it doesn't leave the country. Compare that to the JCPOA, which required Iran to ship out most of its enriched uranium. This is a significantly weaker provision.
On-site down blending also means the knowledge, the infrastructure, the centrifuge cascades, all of it stays. Iran retains the capacity to enrich again at any time. The breakout timeline, the time it would take to produce enough fissile material for a weapon, isn't addressed anywhere in this document. Because addressing it would require defining enrichment limits, centrifuge numbers, stockpile caps, all the things Clause 8 defers to the final deal. The MOU is essentially a promise to have the nuclear conversation later, after the economic benefits have already been delivered.
To answer the prompt's core questions directly, what's actually binding versus what's merely, we intend to negotiate later? The ceasefire is binding immediately. The blockade removal is binding on a 30-day timeline. The oil waivers and asset release are binding immediately. Everything else, nuclear constraints, sanctions termination schedule, reconstruction mechanism, verification, enforcement, is deferred to a final deal that may never materialize. How much is kicked to the 60-day final deal? Almost everything that matters for long-term security. Clauses 3, 6, 7, 8, 9, 12, 13, and 14 all depend on the final deal for their substantive content. That's 8 of the 14 clauses.
The $300 billion reconstruction pledge. Where does it come from? Regional partners who didn't sign the document. Who enforces it? The mechanism is to be determined in the final deal. Sanctions termination is total, but unscheduled. Asset release is immediate. Oil waivers are immediate. The blockade lifts in 30 days. All of these are binding U commitments with specific timelines, while Iran's corresponding commitments are either time-limited, qualified by best efforts, or deferred to negotiation.
The nuclear paragraph, Iran reaffirms it won't build nukes, something it's said for years. While enrichment is merely to be discussed, stockpile disposition awaits a mutually agreed mechanism, and downblending happens on site with no removal requirement. The breakout capability remains intact. That's not a constraint. That's a conversation starter.
The asymmetry is not an accident. It's the structure of the document. The verification gaps are everywhere. Undefined status quo, undefined monitoring mechanism, undefined satisfactory framework. Pakistan's role as mediator adds complexity, but no enforcement capacity. And the UNSC resolution backstop in Clause 14 locks in the deal, but doesn't provide a snapback if Iran violates it. The question I keep coming back to is, what happens on day 61 if there's no final deal and no mutual agreement to extend? The document doesn't say, and that silence is the loudest thing in it.
A document that doesn't contemplate its own failure is not a serious agreement. It's a statement of hope dressed in legal language.
That's where we'll leave it. The MOU stops a war, and that matters. But everything beyond the ceasefire is a promissory note written in vanishing ink. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1904, the Ponta Delgada seismograph was celebrated as the first device to accurately record distant earthquakes from the Azores, until 1923, when researchers realized the instrument had been calibrated upside down for 19 years and was actually measuring the thermal expansion of its own mounting bracket.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. If you want more of this kind of clause, by clause dissection, we'll be watching what happens in the next 60 days. Because the document may be signed, but the actual deal hasn't been written yet.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.